Executives realized it wouldn't be for everybody. People had to make up their own minds, Malone said. You can get yourself into trouble convincing people to get into things. Sure. That makes sense. When you make 10 times your initial investment in less than 2 years, to be fair, an outcome not even Malone could have expected, think of all the horrible tax problems you could cause unsuspecting investors. P.S. Less than a year after the rights offering, Liberty split its stock, 20-for-1. The greater liquidity attracting both institutional investors and analysts. Spinoffs. A quick summary. Before we leave the spinoff area, let's take a moment to review some highlights. 1. Spinoffs in general beat the market. 2. Picking your spots within the spinoff universe can result in even better results than the average spinoff. 3. Certain characteristics point to an exceptional spinoff opportunity. A. Institutions don't want the spinoff, and not because of the investment merits. B. Insiders want the spinoff. C. A previously hidden investment opportunity is uncovered by the spinoff transaction, e.g. a cheap stock, a great business, a leveraged risk-reward situation. 4. You can locate and analyze new spinoff prospects by reading the business press and following up with SEC filings. 5. Paying attention to parents can pay off handsomely. 6. Partial spinoffs and rights offerings create unique investment opportunities. 7. Oh yes, keep an eye on the insiders. Did I already mention that? And some additional points. 1. Reruns of Gilligan's Island are boring. 2. Stealing can be a good thing. 3. Don't ask stupid questions at Lutece. Hey, why didn't I just say it like this in the first place? Chapter 4. Don't try this at home. Risk arbitrage and merger securities. Don't try this at home. Third base coach to runner who just stole third. Risk arbitrage. Risk or merger arbitrage is the business of buying stock in a company that is subject to an announced merger or takeover. Contrary to popular belief, fostered by the exploits of the most infamous arbitrageur, Ivan Boesky, and numerous other insider trading scandals, risk arbitrage generally involves the purchase of a stock after a merger announcement is already made. In its simplest form, Company A announces that it has agreed to acquire all of Company B's stock for $40 per share. Prior to the announcement, Company B traded at $25 per share. After the announcement, Company B's shares trade at $38, not at the proposed acquisition price of $40 per share. A risk arbitrageur, fancy term for the guy who buys the stock at $38, attempts to profit from this discrepancy. Far from a riskless transaction, the arbitrageur takes on 2 risks. First, the deal may not go through for a variety of reasons. These may include regulatory problems, financing problems, extraordinary changes in a company's business, discoveries during the due diligence process. If you've ever purchased a home, this is sort of the house inspection of the merger world. Personality problems, or any number of legally justifiable reasons people use when they change their mind. In the event of a broken deal, Company B's shares may fall back to the pre-deal price of $25 or even lower, resulting in big losses for the arbitrageur. The second risk that the arbitrageur is underwriting is the timing risk. Depending upon the type of deal and industry involved, merger deals can take from 1 to 18 months to close. Part of the $2 spread made by the arbitrageur is payment for the time value of laying out $38 before the close of the deal, when the acquirer purchases all of Company B's shares at $40. One of the arbitrageur's jobs is to assess the time required for the merger to be consummated. Over the last decade, dozens of investment firms and partnerships have entered the risk arbitrage area, once considered a backwater of the securities business. This has made risk arbitrage a very competitive business despite the large volume of mergers. The ability of these firms to follow developments in deals all day long, armed with the advice of antitrust counsel, security lawyers, and industry-specific investment experts, makes this a very difficult investment strategy for the individual to try at home. In addition, the degree of competition keeps the spread between the stock price and the acquisition price relatively low, making risk-adjusted profits tougher to come by. Still want to play? Think I'm just trying to throw cold water on your good time? Like the sound of risk arbitrageur?
Arbitrageur?
Thick as a doorpost? Maybe the next few examples will help you see it my way. Case study. Florida Cypress Gardens, Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. This is one of the first deals I invested in when I started out in business for myself. In April 1985, Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, HBJ, the book publisher and owner of SeaWorld, announced that an acquisition agreement had been reached with Florida Cypress Gardens. Since I remembered and had fond memories of visiting Cypress Gardens as a child, the idea of buying stock in Florida Cypress Gardens gave me a warm and fuzzy feeling inside, in addition to being an investment in a company I knew and understood well. As theme parks go, Cypress Gardens, with its rare and exotic gardens, beautifully landscaped walks, and spectacular water ski shows, complete with water skiing Santa Clauses and chorus girls, was a unique and special place. All right, leave me alone. I was only 7 and I'm trying to tell a story here. Under the terms of the merger agreement, each share of Florida Cypress Gardens would be exchanged for 0.16 of a share of Harcourt Brace. The deal was subject to certain requirements, including approval by shareholders of Florida Cypress Gardens. A shareholder meeting was to be held approximately 3 months after the signing of the merger agreement. Since the chairman of Cypress Gardens owned 44% of the stock outstanding, I didn't think shareholder approval was much of a risk. On the HBJ side, the value of the deal was so small relative to the size of Harcourt Brace that no shareholder vote was even required. The deal certainly seemed to make sense for shareholders of Florida Cypress Gardens. Before the deal was announced, the stock traded at only $4.50 per share. As Harcourt Brace stock was trading at $51.875, a purchase price for Cypress Gardens of 0.16 of a share of HBJ translated to a buyout value of $8.30 per share, 0.16 multiplied by $51.875. After the announcement, shares of Cypress Gardens rose $3 per share to a price of $7.50. This meant that, even after a dramatic 66% rise in value, $3 gain on original price of $4.50, there was still a sizable profit left to be made by arbitrageurs. An arbitrageur could purchase stock in Cypress Gardens at $7.50 and, if the deal closed, make 80 cents per share. The spread. After about 3 months, each share purchased at $7.50 would be exchanged for $8.30 worth of HBJ stock. An 80-cent profit on an investment of $7.50 equaled a return of 10.67% in about 3 months, or on a compounded basis, nearly 50% annualized. 1.1067 times 1.1067 times 1.1067 times 1.1067. You do the math. Compound interest is great, isn't it? The only flaw in the equation was that the $8.30 acquisition price was payable in stock, not cash. If HBJ stock declined even 5 or 10% during the 3 months prior to the closing of the deal, the expected 80-cent profit could be greatly reduced or erased entirely. To eliminate this risk, an arbitrageur would generally sell the shares of HBJ short at the same time he purchased shares in Florida Cypress Gardens. Selling HBJ stock short involved borrowing HBJ shares from a broker and selling them on the open market. An investor who sells stock short has an obligation to replace the borrowed stock at a later date. There is an old Wall Street saying that warns, "He who sells what isn't his'n must buy it back or go to prison." But in the arbitrageur's case, it works a little differently. An arbitrageur will generally sell short 0.16 of a share of HBJ, receiving $8.30 for every share of Florida Cypress Gardens he purchases at $7.50, e.g., a sale of 800 HBJ shares for each 5,000 shares of Florida Cypress Gardens purchased. If and when the merger closed, shareholders of Cypress Gardens would receive 0.16 of a share of HBJ stock in exchange for each of their Cypress Gardens shares. An owner of 5,000 Cypress Gardens shares would receive 800 shares of HBJ. The arbitrageur would then replace the borrowed HBJ stock with the HBJ shares he received in the merger. See, he has to return the borrowed shares, but if the deal closes, he doesn't have to buy them back. After the merger is successfully concluded, the arbitrageur has no stock position and a profit of 80 cents, a 50% annualized return, for each share he purchased of Florida Cypress Gardens. So where's the bad news? This all sounds great, right? No doorposts around here. Well, it seems we left out one small detail. Risk. If the deal didn't go through, instead of a nice juicy 80-cent gain, there would be a big fat $3 loss. On a $7.50 stock yet. Hey, if HBJ ever decided to back out of the deal, maybe it would be because they discovered something seriously wrong with Cypress Gardens. The real Santa couldn't water ski. The flowers were plastic. The books were cooked. You know, the usual stuff. This could mean a trading price below $4.50, and a risk much greater than $3 per share. In this situation, though, the chance of the deal falling apart looked minimal. First, the deal seemed to make a lot of sense. Harcourt Brace owned a SeaWorld theme park in Orlando, not too far from Cypress Gardens. As a result, HBJ was quite familiar with running a tourist attraction, and as mentioned in some of the newspaper accounts, there seemed to be an opportunity to cross-market the two businesses. Second, there was no financing risk in the deal. Harcourt Brace was buying Cypress Gardens with common stock. And besides, relative to the size of HBJ, Cypress Gardens was a tiny acquisition, a mere blip on the radar screen. Further, there were no regulatory issues that I could see. Certainly, antitrust considerations didn't seem to be a relevant factor. And finally, as mentioned earlier, the only vote required, the one by Florida Cypress Gardens' shareholders, was in the bag. So what happened? Oh, nothing much. It's just that a few weeks before the deal was scheduled to close, Cypress Gardens fell into a sinkhole. Before this happened, I really had no idea what a sinkhole was. Apparently, in certain parts of the country, the ground unexpectedly gives way to form a big hole. Risk of sinkhole was not one of my checklist items for determining whether or not to invest in a particular merger deal. The reporter from the Wall Street Journal, obviously not a shareholder of Cypress Gardens, seemed to find some humor in the situation. "For Florida Cypress Gardens, it was a rough day at the office," read the opening line. As it turned out, only the main pavilion had actually fallen into the sinkhole. According to the company's president, there was some noise, and you could see some cement blocks popping out the sides. According to the Wall Street Journal, nobody was hurt, but the company said the loss of the use of the facility will likely result in a reduction of current revenues, the extent of which is unknown as of this date. The company also said its tentative agreement, emphasis added, to be acquired by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, Inc., could be affected. It will take at least 45 days to evaluate the damage and determine the extent of insurance coverage. Florida Cypress said that as a result, it expects filings made with the Securities and Exchange Commission and proxy statements related to the Harcourt merger to be delayed and perhaps revised. I was having a few problems with all this. First off, what was this tentative agreement stuff all about? A deal's a deal in my book. Second, I forgot to mention another little risk. In the time between the merger announcement, when I first purchased my clever arbitrage position, buying Cypress Garden stock, shorting stock in HBJ, and the big sinkhole fiasco, Harcourt Brace's stock had climbed to $60.75. If the deal was eventually called off, since I wouldn't be getting the HBJ stock I had expected in exchange for my Cypress Gardens shares, I would be forced to buy back the stock I had shorted in HBJ. Or go to prison, remember? The added problem was, the stock I had sold for proceeds of $8.30, 0.16 of a share of HBJ at 51.875, was now going to cost me $9.72 to buy back, 0.16 multiplied by $60.75. So in addition to my $3 per share loss on my stock in Florida Cypress Gardens, I was going to lose an additional $1.42, a $9.72 purchase, less an $8.30 sale. That's a $4.42 loss on a $7.50 stock. But wait, if Cypress Gardens facilities were damaged enough for the deal to be called off, maybe the stock could fall to $3.50 or even $2.50 per share. With Florida Cypress Gardens trading at $2.50, my loss would be $6.42 on a $7.50 stock. All this risk for that juicy 80-cent profit. Somehow my warm and fuzzy feeling, my childhood memories, and my money had all fallen down the same sinkhole. In the end, things didn't work out all that terribly. Evidently, the long-term damage to Cypress Gardens wasn't that severe. After a month of nail-biting, the deal was recut from 0.16 share of HBJ to a fixed price of $7.90 worth of HBJ stock, based on a 10-day average price for HBJ prior to completion of the merger. The shareholder vote and close of the merger was rescheduled for mid-August. Since, at the time of the sinkhole announcement, I had to repurchase the HBJ stock I had shorted, or risk further loss if HBJ continued to rise, I ended up losing the approximately $1.42 per share of Florida Cypress Gardens purchased that we spoke about before. I actually ended up making the 40 cents between my purchase price of $7.50 and the $7.90 worth of HBJ stock I received for each share of Florida Cypress Gardens. The bottom line was that in 5 months, I managed to lose about $1 on my $7.50 investment. Considering what I could have lost, I was pretty relieved by the time the deal finally closed. As for my fond childhood memories, you can't put a price on these things, especially not a paltry $1 per share. More bad stuff about risk arbitrage. Of course, that near disaster took place over a decade ago. Now that this sinkhole thing is on everyone's checklist, isn't it safe to get back in the water? What's wrong with just getting your feet a little wet? The truth is, things have only continued to get worse in the risk arbitrage business. Today, if the Cypress Gardens deal were announced with its original terms, instead of an 80-cent spread, the spread would be more like 30 cents, for a compound return of 17% annualized. Partly, this reduction is a result of lower current interest rates, but mostly it is a result of vastly increased competition in the risk arbitrage area. Don't forget, rate of return is only part of the equation. The risk-reward issue, the ratio of how much you can lose in a situation to how much you can make, is a much more important factor in determining long-term profitability. Too often, in an area that has become very competitive, this factor is overlooked in an effort to achieve what appear to be high short-term rates of return. This is especially true in fields like banking, insurance, and the stock market, where a calculator can be too easily substituted for actual thought. That's why I'm trying to lead you to investment areas which, because of the way the system works, will continue to offer extraordinary opportunities. Frankly, risk arbitrage doesn't qualify. I may be unduly soured on the area, considering I once had 7 deals break on me all at the same time. but with the constant attention required to monitor investments properly, and with the other alternatives available to individuals, I believe this is an area best left alone by most investors. But if you're still not convinced. Case Study. Combined International, Ryan Insurance Group. Remember the kid that used to stick out in right field? You know, the one who would always circle under the ball yelling, "I got it, I got it! Oops, I ain't got it!" Well, by the end of this next deal, I was that kid. Let me tell you, it ain't no fun. In July 1982, Combined International agreed to acquire Ryan Insurance Group for a choice of either $34 in cash or $34 worth of Combined International stock. Under the plan, the chairman of Ryan Insurance, Patrick Ryan, was slated to become the new chief executive of the merged companies. Combined's founder, 80-year-old W. Clement Stone, was scheduled to step down as CEO at the deal's close. The deal was subject to the signing of a definitive agreement, to approval of both companies' shareholders, and to standard regulatory approvals. Since Patrick Ryan and his family owned approximately 55% of Ryan Insurance Group, at least one of the shareholders' votes would be easy. The deal sailed through in record time, with a shareholder vote for each company scheduled for the end of August. Although there wasn't much of a spread in the deal, I paid about $32 for my stock, the rate of return looked attractive. After all, a $2 return on a $32 stock in 2 months worked out to a return of 6.25%. On a compounded basis, this was practically a 44% annualized return. Not bad, even though Ryan's stock had been trading at only $18 before the deal was announced. Somehow, the 44% return outweighed the fact that I was trying to make only $2, while risking $14 if the deal didn't go through. While I was aware of the downside, the deal looked relatively riskless. By the time the shareholder meetings rolled around at the end of August, all the ducks were lining up nicely. Of course, this all took place before I knew what a sinkhole was. Usually, in an uncontested merger, there's not much point in attending the special shareholder meeting. It's usually a perfunctory affair, with the outcome a foregone conclusion. That, unfortunately, is not the way W. Clement Stone saw it. Stone, best known for his philosophy of PMA, positive mental attitude, and as a large contributor to President Nixon's campaigns, didn't feel like stepping down quietly. Apparently, according to one report from the meeting, Stone grabbed a microphone and declared that he had changed his mind, adding that there isn't a Pat Ryan or anyone else able to run Combined. Perhaps, Stone suggested, he should stay on as CEO. As one observer summed it up, at the last minute, an 80-year-old man got cold feet about giving up his company. You could see it in his face. Well, the truth is, I didn't see anything. I was sitting at my desk, pounding my glove, waiting for the ball to fall neatly into place. The only thing I knew that afternoon, courtesy of a friend, was that there was some sort of problem and the meeting had been adjourned. As I was working for someone else at the time, and this was my deal, I must have turned a little green. I know this because, although I didn't say anything, my boss asked me what was wrong. You see, in the risk arbitrage business, making the $2 is no big deal. That's the way the business is supposed to work. A dollar here, two there, they all add up. Dropping $14 all at once, though, that's a big deal. You can't have too many of those and expect to stick around too long. It could take 10 more good deals to make up for this one loss. Since I had been confidently saying, I got it, for 2 months, this was no time to yell, oops. When my boss asked me what was wrong, I think I managed to spit out some garbled response along the lines of, there's a little problem, but everything will be fraudulent. My stomach, on the other hand, didn't feel all that fraudulent. In the end, Stone and Ryan were able to iron things out, and the meeting was successfully concluded later that day, but not until after the market had closed. Even though this deal had a happy ending, the problem with risk arbitrage is, to borrow from Yogi Berra, it ain't over till it's over. Too many things have to go right too often. If you care to spend all day playing the averages, you should be able to earn a reasonable return on your investment. That's because, despite everything that can go wrong, most deals close. But a streak of bad luck, or a macroeconomic event, like a stock market crash or another oil shock, can send a portfolio filled with risk arbitrage situations plummeting a lot faster, and a lot more permanently, than a portfolio filled with special corporate situations like spinoffs. When deals fall apart, it's always unexpected. There's just no point in putting yourself, your money, and your stomach through the hassle. If you still want to run around the house with scissors, go ahead. But there are easier and safer ways to make a buck. Like merger securities. Now here's something you may want to try at home. Merger securities. Although cash and stock are the most common forms of payment to shareholders in a merger situation, sometimes an acquirer may use other types of securities to pay for an acquisition. These securities can include all varieties of bonds, preferred stocks, warrants, and rights. Typically, these other securities are used as partial payment, with the bulk of the acquisition price still being paid in cash and/or stock. In many cases, the reason merger securities are used to pay shareholders of the company being acquired is that the acquirer has already exhausted its ability to raise cash, or its desire to issue additional common stock. In other cases, merger securities are used as an additional sweetener to clinch a deal or to outbid a potential acquirer in an auction situation. As a general rule, no one wants merger securities. Like Rodney Dangerfield, they get no respect. Think about it. You're walking along, of course minding your own business, when all of a sudden a takeover bid is announced for your favorite company and largest stock position, Acme Potato. Seeing great synergies in a combination of the two companies, Toppings Inc. has just agreed to purchase each of your shares in Acme for $22 in cash and $3 in face value of Toppings 9% bonds due in 2010. Since shares of Acme Potato had just been trading at $16, this looks pretty good to you. But when the deal closes, what are you going to do with the proceeds? Well, you know what you're going to do with the cash. That's an easy one. You're either going to buy stock in some other company, maybe General Potato, or have a field day buying up everything at the home shopping channel. But what are you going to do with the bonds? You know, the $3 face value of 9% bonds due in 2010? These are bonds that pay interest of 9% on the face value of $3 until the year 2010, when bondholders receive $3 in cash. Well, the bonds might be a good deal. Then again, they might not. The bottom line is, you couldn't care less. When you invested your money in Acme Potato, you were interested in owning stock in a potato company, or a cheap stock, or a potential takeover candidate, or all three, not in owning 9% bonds issued by some other company due whenever. Well, you know what you're going to do with those bonds. You're going to sell them. You're not only going to sell them, you're going to sell them as soon as you get them. In fact, it's going to make you uncomfortable just to have that stuff, whatever it is, lying around. You're going to call your broker and shout, "Hey, I don't want these things. Just get me some real money." So now we know what you're going to do. But what about the sophisticated institutions? They're going to whip out their calculators, figure out the yield to maturity for the bonds issued in the merger, compute the interest coverage ratios, and do a thorough analysis of the synergies and strategic position of the bonds issuer, the new Spud and Toppings King. It certainly makes sense. After all, real professionals get paid to do complicated-sounding stuff like that, right? Well, whether it sounds right or not, it's not even close. They're going to sell their bonds, the same as you. Only they're going to do it even faster. Institutional investors who own stock in a potato company not only have no interest in the bonds of the new conglomerate, in most cases, they're not even allowed to own them. The vast majority of pension and mutual fund managers specialize in either stock investments or bond investments. As a general rule, they're given a specific mandate to invest in one or the other, not both. Even if they can buy both stocks and bonds, it's incredibly unlikely that, out of all the available choices of bond investments, the new toppings bonds are going to head up the list. So in the end, practically everyone who receives merger securities, whether unsophisticated individual or sophisticated institution, is on the same page. Everyone just wants out. It should come as no surprise, then, that this is where you come in. Not unlike, in fact incredibly similar to, the dynamics of a spin-off situation, the indiscriminate selling of merger securities, more often than not, creates a huge buying opportunity. Both spin-offs and merger securities are distributed to investors who are originally investing in something entirely different. Both spin-offs and merger securities are generally unwanted by those investors who receive them. Both spin-offs and merger securities are usually sold without regard to the investment merits. As a result, both spin-offs and merger securities, surprise, surprise, can make you a lot of money. Hopefully, by now you're starting to believe me. But just in case, let's try a few real-world examples. Case study: Super Right Foods. Did you ever want to be a big-time financier? Think you need a lot of money? Well, here's a situation where looking at merger securities turned bus fare into a ride with the big boys. The good news is that the opportunity was spelled out in readily available merger documents. Only, as usual, almost no one bothered to look. In January 1989, an investor group led by the chairman of Super Right Foods made an offer to purchase the shares of Super Right, a grocery chain, for $18 in cash and $5 in face amount of a newly issued preferred stock that paid dividends of 75 cents annually, effectively 15% of its face value each year. A transaction of this type, where management insiders seek to purchase all shares held by the public, is generally referred to as a going private transaction. Going private transactions are particularly interesting because these are situations where the insiders, having decided to purchase the entire equity interest in the company, are indicating a strong conviction regarding the company's future. When available, the opportunity to participate in this type of transaction through the purchase of merger securities is often worth a close look. In this case, as reported in the newspapers, 47% of Super Right was actually owned by Rite Aid Corp., the operator of a large chain of drugstores. Alex Grass, the chairman of Super Right and the leader of the management group, also happened to be the chairman of Rite Aid. According to Mr. Grass, since Rite Aid's board of directors was set on liquidating its stake in Super Right, he and his management group were interested in buying it along with the rest of the company. The management group planned to accomplish this by pursuing a leveraged buyout transaction. This is a technique employed in many going private transactions, whereby a small group of investors is able to purchase a company through borrowings backed by the value of the company being acquired. Here, the management group planned to purchase all of Super Right's shares by investing a relatively small amount of money as equity capital and borrowing the remainder of the $18 per share in cash that was being paid out to Super Right's shareholders. In addition to paying out cash, the proposal also called for Super Right shareholders to receive $5 in face value of new preferred stock. The basic idea was that the future earnings of Super Right would be able to pay the interest on the borrowings and the required dividends under the terms of the preferred stock. This situation is analogous to the purchase of an office building. A 20% cash down payment is made with the remaining 80% of the purchase price borrowed through a mortgage. Hopefully, the rent paid by the tenants will be enough to pay the principal and interest on the mortgage. If things went well for Super Right, the value of the original equity investment made by the management group would multiply as debt was paid down and or the value of the business increased. One good thing about this situation was that the proxy document was going to be particularly informative. As is the case in most going private transactions, the possibility of conflict between the interests of the management group and those of the public shareholders, including in this instance Rite Aid, meant that the Securities and Exchange Commission was going to take an extra hard look at the merger documents to make sure important information was adequately disclosed. Things didn't go too smoothly for the management group, though, after the buyout announcement in January. A number of other interested parties showed up to make a bid for SuperRight, and the board of directors, minus those affiliated with the management bid, was forced to put the company up for auction. Although by March a new agreement had been reached with the same management group, this time the purchase price had been significantly increased. The winning bid for each share of SuperRight now included $25.25 in cash, $2 face amount of a newly issued preferred stock yielding 15% annually, and warrants to buy a 10% interest in the new private company. Since further details about the bid weren't going to be disclosed until the proxy statement was distributed to SuperRight shareholders, at this stage there was really only one important observation to keep in mind. Hey, they're not just paying cash for everyone's stock, they're giving out some other stuff too. What is it? As a general rule, this is the same observation that should turn on the light bulb in your head whenever you read about a situation like SuperRight. Although the Wall Street Journal and other news publications disclose this information, they don't focus on it. That's precisely why you should. Just being aware that merger securities can provide extraordinary profit opportunities puts you at a huge advantage. While thousands of people will be reading the same headline, you will be focusing your attention and efforts in an area most people ignore. And because almost everyone's a seller, even if more people discover your little secret, there should still be plenty of merger securities to go around. That's just the way the system works. Combine the proper focus with a little research, and you can make the system work for you. As for SuperRight, just reading some of the information provided in the proxy turned out to be an excellent roadmap to future profits. Distributed in August, the proxy outlined the terms of the merger, including a description of the two merger securities. Of course, the $25.25 in cash was pretty straightforward. The $2 in face value of preferred stock, paying 15% annually, or as the proxy called it, the Senior Cumulative Redeemable Exchangeable Preferred Stock, was a slightly different story. What looked interesting about the preferred, though, was that each shareholder was only getting $2 face value worth for each share of SuperRight they owned, compared to the over $25 worth of cash being paid out in the deal. The preferred would account for only a very small part of the value received by SuperRight shareholders in the buyout. This would provide a further incentive for SuperRight shareholders to simply disregard the investment merits of the preferred stock. The other merger security, the warrants to acquire, at no cost to the holder, a 10% interest in the acquiring company, looked even more interesting. In general, warrants represent the right to buy stock in a company at a specified price. In this case, since the specified price was zero, warrant holders were actually stockholders in the leveraged buyout alongside management insiders. Shareholders of SuperRight were entitled to receive a set amount of warrants for each of the shares they owned in SuperRight. Since the warrants would trade publicly after the buyout was completed, anyone who wanted to participate in the leveraged buyout could simply purchase the warrants on the open market from SuperRight shareholders who chose to sell them. According to the proxy, SuperRight shareholders would receive one warrant for every 21.44 shares of SuperRight held. This fraction of a warrant, according to investment bankers hired by SuperRight, was worth between 25 and 50 cents per SuperRight share. If SuperRight stockholders were going to sell their preferred stock without too much thought, given the even smaller value of the warrants, there appeared to be a good chance that the warrants would be sold without any thought. In fact, for several months after the merger was completed, it was possible to buy the warrants very cheaply. Each warrant gave the holder the right to purchase one share in the acquiring company formed by SuperRight management. Since it took 21.44 shares of SuperRight to be entitled to receive one warrant, a warrant price of $6, the approximate trading price during that period, translated to approximately 28 cents worth of warrants. $6 divided by 21.44 for each share of SuperRight. Hardly enough for, well, anything. Of course, $6 is what the warrants traded for, but what were they really worth? That's where reading the proxy really helped. Under the section entitled Certain Projections, SuperRight's management projected that in 3 years, a new customer that SuperRight had recently obtained would be contributing over $80 million in added sales per year. According to this section of the proxy, the new entity formed by management to purchase SuperRight would be earning $5 per share in after-tax free cash flow by that time. What's free cash flow? It's like earnings, only better. Don't get it? Don't worry, it's not hard and it's all in Chapter 7. Even at a modest multiple of 10 times free cash flow per share, the new shares would be worth $50 each. That would make the warrants, the ones trading at $6, also worth $50 each, since the right to buy one share worth $50 at no cost would be worth $50. Although I am usually skeptical about long-term projections, in this case I felt that since management was buying the business, they must be confident about its future. Further, even if the actual value of the business was significantly below $50 in 3 years, that still left a lot of room for warrant holders to walk away with a large profit. In short, buying the warrants at $6, although speculative, looked like a very good deal. What about buying stock in SuperRight before the merger closed? I could have effectively purchased the warrants and preferred stock at an even cheaper price by buying shares in SuperRight at $25.50, or $26 in September, just before the merger closed. Since I would be getting $25.25 in cash for my SuperRight shares when the merger was completed, a $26 purchase of SuperRight would have allowed me to create a net purchase price of only 75 cents for both the $2 in face value of preferred stock and the warrants, or at least 28 cents worth of warrants. Then again, if for some reason the deal collapsed, SuperRight might return to its pre-deal price of $17 or even lower. Add to that the fact that I would only be getting 28 cents worth of warrants for every $26 I laid out, and the desire to pursue this option quickly faded. In the end, buying warrants, and maybe preferred stock, in the open market seemed like the best way to go. How did it all turn out? In short, very well. SuperRight decided to go public again just 2 years after the merger closed. The warrants that had initially traded at $6 were valued at over $40 by the time shares in the management buyout were offered to the public. The preferred also did pretty well. While for several months after the buyout took place, preferred shares could be purchased for between 50 and 60% of their face value, by the time the public offering was completed, the preferred was worth 100% of face value. This return didn't include the 15% in dividends paid out annually in the form of additional preferred stock. Keep in mind, investing in the securities of a leveraged buyout is generally risky business. However, it's not often that individuals have the opportunity to invest alongside management and big-time financiers. It's even more rare to be able to do so through securities that are publicly traded and available at discount prices. Merger securities. Be there. Aloha. Case study. Paramount Communications, Viacom. Well, as long as everyone has a hula skirt on, let's take a look at a knockdown, drag-out takeover fight that hit the front pages for nearly 6 months. Luckily, the fight ended in a multi-billion dollar sea of merger securities. Despite the huge amount of press the battle for Paramount Communications received, most investors missed the biggest opportunity to profit from this highly publicized situation. In September 1993, Viacom agreed to purchase Paramount Communications for stock and cash. Viacom, a media conglomerate controlled by Sumner Redstone, was the owner of cable services, like MTV, Nickelodeon, and Showtime, cable systems, broadcast stations, and television distribution and production divisions. In what appeared to most analysts to be a good fit with Viacom, a combination with Paramount would contribute a leading producer and distributor of motion picture and television programming, a book publisher, Simon & Schuster, more cable channels, more television stations, and 2 sports teams. Particularly attractive to Viacom was Paramount's extensive library of past movie and television hits, as well as access to the future output of Paramount's film and television studios. Also trying to expand his media empire, Barry Diller, originator of the Fox Television Network and chairman of the QVC Home Shopping Service, launched a competing bid for Paramount, just 1 week after the Viacom announcement. After a 5-month bidding war, Viacom finally prevailed. But not before significantly raising and changing the nature of its initial bid. During this period, in an effort to increase the strength of its offer, Viacom announced a merger with Blockbuster Entertainment. That merger was scheduled to close shortly after the successful acquisition of Paramount. Because of the high-profile nature of all the companies involved, and the high-powered machinations of a slew of lawyers and investment bankers, the battle made interesting reading until a winner was determined in February 1994. At that time, Viacom was able to purchase, for cash, 50.1% of Paramount's shares outstanding. Although the contest was over and the Paramount story faded from the headlines, the opportunity to profit from the merger had only begun. The closing of the deal would not take place until after a Paramount shareholder meeting in July 1994. Since Viacom had purchased 50.1% of Paramount in February, the vote to approve the merger was a mere formality. What wasn't so formal was the method of payment for the remaining 49.9% of Paramount. While cash was the sole form of payment for purchasing the first half of Paramount stock, practically everything except cash was the form of payment for the second half of the merger, known as the back end of the merger. Mentioned, but certainly not focused on in the Wall Street Journal, the back-end payment for each share of Paramount consisted of 1. Viacom common stock, 2. Exchangeable subordinated debentures of Viacom, 3. Securities known as contingent value rights, 1 for each share of Viacom common stock received in the merger, 4. 3-year warrants to purchase Viacom common stock at $60 per share, and 5. 5-year warrants to purchase Viacom common stock at $70 per share. All the information about the merger and this strange collection of merger securities was provided to Paramount shareholders in a proxy statement issued in June. This information was readily available, but most shareholders had no interest in finding out what any of it meant. The vast majority of Paramount shareholders were interested in owning the shares of an entertainment conglomerate or the stock of a takeover candidate. While Viacom common stock might have been of interest to some of these shareholders, the exchangeable debentures, the contingent value rights, and the 2 types of warrants were going to be sold, without looking at the proxy document, and without regard to their true value. Even the common stock of Viacom, the security with the best chance of being retained by Paramount shareholders, was going to come under heavy selling pressure. According to the proxy document, the Viacom stock issued to the public as part of the merger consideration would nearly triple the supply of Viacom stock in public hands. Although the proxy was quite long, the sections outlining the merger securities were not very extensive. In fact, if you really wanted to answer the question, "What is all this stuff?" a 3-page section entitled Paramount Merger Consideration pretty well summed it up. Not surprisingly, each of the merger securities turned out to be pretty interesting. For instance, combining the purchase of 1 share of Viacom common stock with the purchase of 1 contingent value right, CVR, created a unique investment opportunity. The contingent value right was a security issued by Viacom to help guarantee the value of the back-end securities that Paramount shareholders were to receive in the merger. It was probably this guarantee of value by Viacom that was responsible for its victory in the bidding war over Paramount. The contingent value rights worked in the following way. If Viacom common stock traded below $48 1 year after the completion of the Paramount merger, Viacom would make up the difference through a payment to holders of the CVRs. E.g., if Viacom stock traded at $44 on the 1 year anniversary of the merger's close, Viacom would pay $4 for each CVR. If Viacom traded at $38 at that time, Viacom would pay $10 for each CVR. By purchasing one CVR for each share of Viacom he owned, an investor could ensure that the combined value of the two securities would be at least $48 in 1 year. If Viacom stock traded higher than $48, let's say to $55, then, although the CVR would be worthless, the combined value of the two securities would be $55, even better than the guaranteed $48 price. Since, shortly after the merger was completed, one CVR and one share of Viacom stock could be purchased for a combined price of $37, a guaranteed price of $48 in 1 year looked pretty good. A 30% annual return with little risk and no upside limitation. Okay, there were a few little bells and whistles I left out. For one thing, Viacom limited the payout on the CVRs to a maximum of $12. Even so, Viacom stock could fall to $25 before an investor who bought both the CVR and Viacom stock for a combined $37 would lose money. For another, Viacom could extend the payment date of the CVR, but only in exchange for a payout larger than $12. Although the contingent value rights had even more bells and whistles, beyond the specifics of this particular example, there is a larger point to keep in mind. I didn't learn about CVRs in business school. I didn't read any books that described what these things were. No one told me to buy them. I simply read the page in the proxy that told me how they worked. However, I did have an advantage in all this. I did know something that very few other investors knew. My big advantage and what I knew was this. It pays to check out merger securities. The takeover of Paramount provided a prime example of the kind of investment opportunities that can open up just by looking in this area. Of course, contingent value rights weren't the only merger securities issued in the Paramount deal. A few others, actually all the others, were worth a close look. One of the securities, the 5-year warrants to buy Viacom stocks at $70 per share, looked particularly interesting. These warrants gave the holder the right to buy Viacom stock at $70 per share for a period of 5 years. Since Viacom stock was trading at about $32 per share in July 1994, shortly after the Viacom warrants had been distributed to Paramount shareholders, the right to buy Viacom stock at $70 didn't look too enticing. On the other hand, with this type of situation, I like to think about the old story of the peasant who was brought before the king and sentenced to death. The peasant says, "Oh, please, please, your majesty, spare me. If you let me live just 1 year, I will teach the royal horse to talk." "Sure," responds the king, figuring, "What the heck? If you can teach my horse to talk in 1 year, I will set you free." On the way out of the royal palace, one of the king's guards pulls the peasant aside and asks, "Why'd you tell the king that you could make his horse talk? When the year is up, he will surely have you beheaded." The peasant replies, "I'm not so sure about that. A year's an awful long time. If I have a whole year, maybe the king will change his mind. Or maybe the king will die. Maybe the horse will die. Maybe I'll die. Or who knows? If you give him a year, maybe the horse will talk. So if anything can happen in 1 year, just imagine what could happen to Viacom stock in 5 years. Forget Viacom stock, imagine all the dead kings, dead peasants, and talking horses you could have. After all, Viacom was borrowing a lot of money to finance the acquisition of Paramount. Remember, by using a lot of leverage, the value of Viacom stock could increase dramatically with an increase in the value of Viacom's assets. Also, Sumner Redstone, the owner of a majority of Viacom's common stock, was betting nearly his entire multi-billion-dollar fortune on the success of the merger. Besides, 10 months earlier, Viacom stock had traded as high as $60 per share. In addition, these were merger securities, bound to be trading at a cheap price. But as impressive as all this sounds, none of the reasons were the main reason why the 5-year warrants to buy Viacom at $70 looked interesting. The main reason the 5-year warrants looked interesting could be found right in the 3-page section describing the Paramount merger consideration. According to the proxy, the 5-year warrants gave the holder the right to buy Viacom stock at any time during the next 5 years for $70. In the case of an ordinary warrant, this would mean that the warrant holder was entitled to receive one share of Viacom common stock in exchange for $70 in cash. But this was no ordinary warrant. In this case, the warrant holder had a choice. The $70 could be paid in cash, and there was nothing unusual about that. However, the $70 could also be paid with $70 in face value of one of the other Paramount merger securities. Which merger security? The exchangeable subordinated debentures I mentioned earlier. Item 2 on our list. The good thing was that, shortly after the Paramount merger was completed, these merger securities were trading at 60% of their face value. This meant that I could buy $70 of face value of these securities for only $42, 60% of $70. If I also bought the 5-year warrants to buy Viacom stock, under certain circumstances outlined in the proxy, I would effectively have the right to buy Viacom stock not for $70, but for only $42 worth of merger securities. I would have this right for 5 years. Viacom was at $32. The right to buy stock at $42 for 5 years was a lot more valuable than the right to buy stock at $70. If I hadn't read the portion of the proxy covering merger securities, there was no way I could have known this opportunity existed. For anyone who still cares, there was, believe it or not, yet another twist. If the proposed merger between Viacom and Blockbuster was later completed, which it was, the terms of the warrants would change, and the value of the exchangeable subordinated debentures would dramatically increase. You don't want to know the details, but the bottom line was, no matter what happened, buying both warrants and debentures was a winning trade. Once again, although this may seem complicated, the particulars of this situation aren't relevant. The important thing is that I didn't learn any of this in school. No one told me that the Paramount merger securities had all of these weird provisions. I just knew enough to read about the merger securities in the proxy. The proxy explained how the securities worked. Most likely, the next bunch of merger securities will have totally different provisions. Just remember to read about them. Only invest in the ones that are attractive and that you understand. Of course, just by looking for bargains in an attractive area like merger securities, you should be way ahead of the game. Even in a high-profile takeover like Paramount, most investors didn't pay close attention to the merger securities. Since most takeovers don't make the front page for months at a time, it's no wonder that merger securities in more typical situations are completely ignored. Fortunately, most are easier to understand than the ones in the Paramount merger. But unless you make the effort to read about them, you'll miss the chance to profit from a tremendously lucrative area. Merger securities, be there. Wait, I already said that. A quick summary. 1. Risk arbitrage. No. 2. Merger securities. Yes. 3. The square of the hypotenuse of a right triangle is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides. I threw this one in because the summary was so short. Chapter 5, aka Chapter 11. Blood in the streets, hopefully not yours. Bankruptcy and restructuring. Bankruptcy. Bankruptcy, Chapter 11, El Tanco. That's all, folks. However you say it, bankruptcy doesn't sound like the land of opportunity. The truth is that it is, and it isn't. The corner of the investment world occupied by companies at some stage of the bankruptcy process is filled with opportunities and landmines. Probably the best way to approach this area, as my father might say, is with an open mind, but not a hole in your head. While the securities of companies involved in one stage or another of bankruptcy are often mispriced, that doesn't necessarily mean all bankruptcy-related securities are cheap. On the contrary, when it comes to investing in the bankruptcy area, picking your spots is the only way to avoid going El Tanco yourself. After we review and eliminate some of the investment alternatives within the bankruptcy world, you should be able to add, picking your spots within the bankruptcy area to your arsenal of investment weapons. Companies end up in bankruptcy court for all sorts of reasons. A lousy business is only